Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Last week, French President Macron made waves when he said that he had not ruled out sending ground troops to fight in Ukraine. The statement prompted a strong reaction from Russian President Putin, who warned that sending troops to Ukraine could result in direct war between NATO and Russia, and even a potential nuclear conflict. However, criticism of Macron's comments were not limited to Russia, and many of France's NATO allies were quick to make clear that they were not considering sending troops to Ukraine, aiming to distance themselves from what they viewed as a potential source of escalation. One of the most notable instances of this came from German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who asserted that soldiers from NATO countries should not, quote unquote, actively participate in war events. This latest Franco-German spat fits within a larger trend of disagreement between Paris and Berlin, and it comes at a time when European leaders are increasingly warning about the risks of conflict with Russia. To discuss the implications of these recent events, we're very pleased to have Camille Grand and Claudia Mayor with us on the podcast today. Camille and Claudia, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello.
Brief bios. Camille is a distinguished policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He leads the organization's work on defense and disruptive technologies in European security. And Claudia is head of the International Security Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin. And her research focuses on European and transatlantic security and defense policy. So maybe we'll start, we had lots to cover today, but maybe let's start with these kind of repeated rifts between Germany and France. And Claude, maybe I'll start with you just to give your sense of what's happening and how would you characterize the current moment in Franco-German relations?
I think if you look back at the last weeks, but if we are honest on the last months or even last 2 years, I would say it has been a very bad and a very difficult time. And we could look just back at the last weeks. And for example, we could look at the Munich Security Conference where France and Germany were not together, didn't stand up together. They signed the security arrangements with Ukraine separately one day after the other. In the speech the Chancellor Scholz made at the Munich Security Conference, there was little hidden criticism to France. When he refused, when he explained why he's refusing to deliver the Taurus missiles to Ukraine, he said, we cannot do what France and the UK are doing, and they're actually sharing operational security information, which one doesn't do. So, and then Macron carried on with the, we should not exclude troops on boots on the ground, which was misunderstood or maybe on purpose misunderstood in Germany because it was turned into combat troops, what nobody said. So we could carry on with that list, but the main idea is the two don't get on and there is a deep misunderstanding and particularly there's a lack of willingness to understand. And I think it's due to two different sets of factors. The one is the old traditional structural difference, which we all know, which are not new and about which we have been talking for decades. It's a different political system, parliamentary system, presidential system, the different role of the parliament, very strong in Germany, not very strong in France, and the different model of defense industry in Germany, small and medium-sized privately owned companies in France, very big ones. This is, we all know this, different international ambitions. I think what's a new element over the last years is that President Macron, since he took office in 2017, has a strong tendency to what I would call hyper-presidentiality, or how you say that in English, Camille? Hyper-presidentialism?
Hyper-presidency?
Yeah, so it means that he is even more than his predecessors concentrating power in the Élysée Palace, and that means that the most important decisions are taken there. And that doesn't leave much room for maneuver for the ministers. But in Germany, the ministers have quite some authority and competences to decide. But then they meet with their French counterparts and there's a certain asymmetry. And that means that the most important decisions are taken at the head with the chancellor and the president. And if they don't get on, and they don't get on, the whole system is blocked. We have lots of institutional cooperation structures between France and Germany. So many exchange offices, Franco-German ministerial council meetings, and so many cooperation things. But they can't really deliver if the power is concentrated at the president's office. And then everything has literally to be decided between the president and the chancellor. So it's more or less blocked. And my impression is that this has really blocked cooperation in addition to personalities. So now it has been public for some while that Scholz and Macron are not on the same page. And to that, maybe the last point, you have increasing kind of misperceptions or criticism that Paris directs at Berlin and Berlin directs at Paris. I'm curious to see whether Camille would agree, but France, seen from Germany, France seems to be a difficult partner, uncoordinated, disruptive, unpredictable. So France positions are often different to Germans, that's fine. But they seem to be disruptive, like proposing a European political community without having coordinated, not excluding ground troops without having coordinated. Paris seems to be, from a Berlin point of view, very often dogmatic on defense industrial issues, like you have to buy European. West Germans are like, let's be a bit more pragmatic, let's rather buy quickly so we fill our shortfalls and, you know. But what I also have to recognize is that from a French perspective, Germany is not an easy partner either. Germany talks about the Zeitenwende, but the Zeitenwende so far is transatlantic and national. There's no big European initiative. The most important decisions in the area of defense have been coordinated with the US. If it's about delivering tanks or not, it's only with the US. It's about NATO enlargement, so Ukraine membership in NATO, it's coordinated with the US. And Germany teams up with the US against the rest of the European allies. So it's really transatlantic. And I can understand that many countries are like, okay, where's the European initiative? Where's the European coordination? And why there is not more? So I think there is a certain amount of misunderstandings and criticism on both sides that make it more and more difficult to get on. Also, because I think in the end, this war, Russia's war against Ukraine, has confirmed France and Germany in their key assumptions. For Germany, the key assumption is we need the US to be safe in Europe. And the French key assumption is we need European sovereignty to be stronger because we don't know how long the Americans will be around. And this war shows us that it's really important that Europe is capable to act. So in the end, both have been shocked by the war. Both have been reconfirmed. Both have reconfirmed their assumptions, and it leaves them on opposite sides. And this makes it so terribly difficult in the moment to get on.
Kami, from your view.
Yeah, I guess I very much agree with the way Claudia describes the situation. So I will only add a few things. First of all, let's not overemphasize the interpersonal dimension of the things. Yes, they don't get along. Yes, Macron is a disruptor. Yes, Scholz is extremely stubborn. And the two of them, the chemistry between the two of them doesn't seem to be great. But it's been about 20 years that the image of the French president and the German chancellor being best buddies has disappeared. You know, the last were Schröder and Chirac. And there was a tradition before that, but it's not been around, I would say, since the Merkel years, who never was super friendly with neither Sarkozy, Hollande, nor Macron. So that's not the issue of the interpersonal relationship. What bothers me a little bit is the fact that we've now beyond a policy of no surprise policy. So I will not, you know, we might disagree, but I'm not going to take you by surprise, or we're not going to go public over our disagreement, and we're going to try to iron those disagreements. And that has a bit vanished, which is very unfortunate in a way, because in the broader sense, the two countries' policies I would argue overlap about 80%. You know, Germany has been doing much more for Ukraine than at the beginning of the war. We are way past the moment where Germany was reluctant to support Ukraine with the real military stuff. It's now the second largest provider of arms to Ukraine after the US. And it has become a critical element in the support of Ukraine. The French are doing an effort to catch up after being not as good in terms of numbers, and are delivering stuff that Germany is more reluctant to deliver. So that you could say that the two policies are mutually supporting each other. But instead of that, both leaders appear to compete, to poke at each other by saying, you don't do as much as I do in terms of high-end equipment, or you don't do as much as I do in terms of money and and all of that. So, and finally, the Paris conference of about 10 days ago, where 21 nations, including the US, but at a more junior level, took part to have a conversation about what do we do to support Ukraine in the long term, is in fact a great success. There's been a recommitment of 21 countries to say that this is really important and we're ready to do more. And it's a bit of a pity that what came out of it was this spat over boots on the ground and what form should it take, rather than having a sort of good news story, which is the West is united in supporting Ukraine and we're going to do whatever it takes and we're going to ramp up things. And which would have been a good message for the Ukrainians, a good message for Washington as well, as you're stuck in your own domestic debates of saying the Europeans are doing their fair share, and a good message also to Putin by saying, you think strategic patience is on your side, it's not. And we end up with a sort of rather unfortunate conversation, which from my perspective should have remained private, but was a very important and legitimate one that Macron started. The pity is that he went public. Paradoxically, he went public because the Slovak Prime Minister, Fico, who's not the biggest supporter of Ukraine, blew the story about troops on the ground. So in the blaming game, there is a sort of third guy who threw a grenade and started this whole fight. Which was not necessary.
Yeah, it's such an important point. For all the reasons that you said, it should have been a positive message, and yet it ended up being so terribly counterproductive because then it forced all of the different capitals to come back and say, no, we're not sending troops on the ground, which is then the wrong signal to send to Putin. So I agree with everything the way that you characterized it, Camille. But Claude, what were you going to add?
What Camille said, I totally agree, and I would put it in this kind of, we are lacking the bilateral reflex in the Franco-German relationship. And the Franco-German relationship was never about being on the same page and about agreeing on everything. The Franco-German relationship was about, we are on different positions, the French and the Germans, but we make a conscious effort to overcome it for the greater European good. And if we succeed in agreeing, everybody else in Europe could buy in. And this reflex, I first call Paris, I first call Berlin, and then I go out and I make a deliberate effort. This reflex is in the moment not there. And I agree with you, Camille, that the big buddy times have been over for quite some while. But if you have so much power concentration in Paris at the Elysee Palace, it does have an impact whether the president gets on with the chancellor or not. So I think I would put this bilateral reflex, which has to be relearned. It has to be relearned that I first contact the other to find out some common ground before going out. And I think the Paris conference was about doing more for Ukraine and was about doing it differently. And this doing differently included to think about new ways being more present in Ukraine and improving the performance. It was not about NATO combat troops. It was not about combat troops at all. It was about things like mine clearing, maintenance, training, things like that. But it has been communicated in a way by Macron that was not helpful. It has been taken up by Germany in a way that was not helpful. The problem for me is it's not a one-off. As I earlier mentioned, the Munich Security Conference for me would have been the moment where the Europeans, France, Germany, the UK, and Poland stand together on the big scene and say, this is a moment of Europe, we help Ukraine, US, we understood, we will take more of the burden. And it didn't happen. it would have been the opportunity to sign the security agreements together. It didn't happen either. So for me, the problem is not only that the Paris conference, the kind of boot on the ground issue, overshadowed the positive dimension, but that we have had that for the last 2 years. Remember the tank decision, where we had the same kind of mise-en-scène like we have now, with the Brits say something, the French say something, Germany aligns with the US and say something different. So I think it's an overarching pattern. But, and I think in the moment we have now in Europe, with the US in being inward-looking and totally occupied by the elections, and Ukraine really doing badly, we can't afford this kind of, there's a German word, it's like kindergarten games in the sandbox.
Yeah. If I could jump in. First, what we just heard from both of you is just really fabulous. I do hope this particular podcast has a wide reach, because I think you both laid it out so well. And I just wanted to add just a couple of things. One is that from Washington, and I'll just speak for myself here, but when the Paris meeting happened, it followed a few days after some remarks by Trump about NATO, and also it was with the background of what was happening in the House of Representatives in terms of the supplemental, and it was just looked dead on arrival. And so a lot of what was coming out of Washington, both politically as well as on the Hill, showed a U.S. Potentially pulling away, and showed something that Europe really need to be worried about. And so when the Paris meeting was announced, and I don't know, maybe it had been in the works for months, I don't know, but when the Paris meeting was announced, and the nations met in Paris to talk about, filling in the U.S. gaps, how can we do things different? You could see the attempt of Europe to really say, we have got to get together and figure this out, because we don't know where the U.S. is going. I was very happy to see that meeting. I was very happy to hear about that meeting. To me, it was at a level of nations really trying to get traction, because the U.S. Was not giving any hope that we were going to be there in a year or so from now. And it was an anecdote to what Trump was saying about, well, the Russians can go and do whatever they want to, whatever the hell they want to do with those countries that don't pay up. I mean, this was Europe taking action. And so that was number one. I think the background to the meeting was very well received as far as I was concerned. But I think probably a lot of Washington was that way, too. Secondly, I think what's important for people to know is what Macron said in terms of boots on the ground, if you will, or forces. You know, it wasn't just Macron spouting off something that came out of his own mind. I understand from people who were there that there was a discussion about this. And there are people who really want this to be talked further about. And I have a great sympathy to that. I mean, it's still a bit vague what we're talking about, et cetera. But potentially we're looking at this year, if things begin to really deteriorate with Ukraine in terms of the lines, we could be faced with having to ratchet up participation a bit and having Europe talk about this first, without Washington coming in and saying backfill and all the things that we've said in the past. Having this come out of Europe and having Macron saying it, who I look on as an important European leader, obviously, to me was very good. I know that he was outed, he kind of had to say it, and I know that there were some unfortunate reactions caused by that. But hearing that before I heard the blowback, I felt that Europe was really being serious, and that they were saying things that usually it's the U.S. that pops out to say, and here it was coming out of Europe. But the third thing is, with the blowback, though, was so unfortunate. I think for me, that was the blowback that was so unfortunate, because it was so so forceful. It wasn't just, someone saying, well, he shouldn't have said that. It was quite... not just from Germany, but from other places too, quite a forceful blowback. And to me, I didn't want that to be seen in Moscow as fear. Oh my God, no, we're not saying that. And then that recoil making Putin feel that he can see now where the red lines are in Europe very well. And so it was the blowback, the recoil to me, and then coupled with what Putin said the next day about the nuclear aspect, the nuclear nightmare, and linking what was said to, okay, you want the nuclear nightmare? You know, he was always alluding to that earlier on. This time he was very black and white, very pointed. And again, he got this, oh, no, 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 no. So I'm of two minds here. The Paris meeting was great. The discussions there were serious. I like the fact that this, it was openly talked about, but the cost, I think, was there too in terms of the recoil and what Putin might have interpreted from the recoil in Europe. So that's kind of how I looked on that. I don't know about Andrea and her, how she viewed it, but looking at the future, I hope we see more Paris meetings. I hope we see more European leaders being very upfront about this, how serious it is, because the United States has to get serious too.
Well, let me translate this into a question, Jim, though, because, well, there's two things. One, I agree, like the conversation about the troops, sending troops is serious and it's well-intentioned and it is a serious attempt by Europe to kind of think about what to do given the way that things are going. But it seems a little bit like putting the ox before the cart. Like, do we have a theory of victory, and is sending troops to Ukraine part of that? Like, it felt there like a sequencing, the sequencing it was off. It would be useful for Europeans to come together and have a serious theory of what it takes to be successful in Ukraine and then work back and then understand what's needed in order to do that. And then the second, this is the question, and we'll start with you, Kami, is to me, this came a little bit out of left field from the French. They, to me, and I think many in Washington view them as largely absent and lagging in their support for Ukraine. So it was like going from what looked like very little support for Ukraine relative to Germany and others in Europe to all of a sudden talking about sending troops. And so I want to help us understand where this was coming from Macron's perspective.
Let me try to unpack a lot of what Jim raised and from your question, Andrea, on two things. First of all, under the theory of victory, I think you're absolutely right. It's important to try to define what is it that we want to achieve. And my understanding is that Macron's mindset at the moment, but also what was behind the Paris effort, the Paris conference effort, is to say, okay, how do we prevent a Russian victory? So what sort of message do we send to the Russians? What sort of message do we send to the Ukrainians so that the current moment where they are deprived of ammunition because of the West collective failure to deliver on time, where there is a talk about, you know, the resumption of talks about, you know, should Ukraine be thrown under the bus at some point by Trump or someone else, and so on, to come up with a strong message of no, that's not going to happen because it's our security that's at stake. And we're going to do whatever it takes, and that whatever it takes opens the range of the possible. Then, so that's the starting point. Second point, that what Macron was trying to do is to recreate strategic ambiguity and uncertainties for Putin.
Right.
By saying, rather than saying, we will not do, and there I'm 100% with him, not necessarily on the way he did it, but on the substance.
Right. You know,
We keep saying what we will not do from day one. We won't do this, we won't do that, we want, you know, the red lines. And then, we change those red lines because sometimes we sort of decide, okay, it's better to do long-range fires and stuff. Create a situation, and that's what I think he tried to do with the discussion about boots on the ground, which I think was largely misinterpreted, mostly for domestic reasons, by a number of his peers who sort of went, whoa, 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 I haven't discussed that with my parliament, I haven't discussed that with my public opinion, so I'm just going to say no, so I don't get into this. And this is where there might have been a handling issue. But I think it's fair to open the range of the possible from, Are there new types of weapons that are going to be delivered? Are these new types of do these new types of weapons require some presence in Ukraine to support them? You know, do you fly F-16 without any form of presence on site? Are those going to be contractors or are those going to be your own folks? I don't know. I'm not suggesting that F-16s come with a, you know, Dutch and Danish airmen on the ground, but I'm just saying that there is a question about how do you do this. Second, when you deliver more sophisticated weapons, it requires more support. Is that support provided by experts or contractor? Is it possible to do it from outside Ukraine? Does it require a little more than that? Thirdly, we have a big discussion about manpower in Ukraine. Can some sort of a presence on site of not necessarily combat troops enable the Ukrainians to have more soldiers on the front line? And so the bottom line is that what should have been we don't intend to fight the Russians on the front line, which is fine. And that's nobody wants to turn this into a NATO versus Russia war, Macron included, ended up in the blowback that Jim described of having we will never do this from Scholz to the State of the Union, which is a sort of different story there. And I think so. We are missing the sophistication of the debate that we need. Last thing, just on your question, Andrea, on the fact that, in fact, this has been prepared. So it's not a Macron out of the blue saying something in a press conference. There are a lot of evidence that this discussion had been ongoing privately amongst key allies, with exchanges with the US, with Germany, with the French IDs and scenarios being shared with them. So the argument of I was taken by surprise is technically not true. The issue then becomes, should it be a public or a private conversation? And there I would argue with those who say it would have been better if it had been a private conversation. And probably Macron could have phrased it differently of saying, we discussed a number of options, nothing is off the table, but I'll leave it at that because those were classified and sensitive conversations. And that would have been great. Finally, the last point on this is the issue of managing the timeline. And that's because I think there Macron has a point on saying, you know, we don't know if we don't start the conversation now as Europeans and amongst Europeans, you know, it's what does it mean to be in panic mode if Trump is elected in November and starts saying that he will settle Ukraine overnight? What does it mean if the Ukrainian front line is really struggling? And if we do genuinely believe it's our security that's at stake in this, shouldn't we have some sort of contingency planning for extreme circumstances that are not in the cards yet, but that are important? So I think that's the whole story there.
One clarifying question. I think when I was saying out of the blue, I meant not that so much that this line of discussion was teed up for diplomatic engagement and conversations, but out of the blue in the sense that France really hasn't provided all that much in terms of assistance to Ukraine. They haven't been one of the active supporters on the front lines pushing. And so to go from kind of being a reluctant partner of Ukraine to all of a sudden talking about putting troops, that to me was what was jarring.
Just in one sentence, and it's going to be interesting to hear also Claudia's perspective on that as a good Macron watcher. Macron has been gradually shifting. And of course, there is a different Macron from the first 6 months where he was the last one still engaging Putin to today. But I think it is also part of a very deliberate learning process on his part of saying, you know, A, this guy is not reliable. B, what's happening in Ukraine is really critical for Europe, not only for Ukraine. And C, and I would put this in this speech in Bratislava in the spring 23, a real shift in terms of his understanding and his narrative about the conflict and about European security that he's been building up since. in the speech in Bratislava, in his recent visit in Stockholm. So he's been much more outspoken on this. So if you watch it closely, it's been a transition, but I think he's been quite consistent on his views since then. And he's also been trying to catch up when it comes to assistance to Ukraine. I mean, the figures are always debated, but the French just released their own math about what they're doing, which is less than Germany. And he can be open to question, but it is also quite not as insignificant as others have suggested.
Claude, you can weigh in too on your perceptions of Macron and how he has evolved. But I think, I mean, Germany is the second largest provider now, but there's some interesting reluctancies on the part of Berlin, thinking about the Eurobond issue, the EPF issue, and their reluctance to go after the frozen Russian assets. So talk to us a little bit about, I mean, feel free to weigh in on anything that Camille just said, but those are, I think, still remaining questions on the German side. And it raises a lot of questions about why there's the reluctance to move out on those areas.
I very much support what Camille just said about the opportunity or not used or missed opportunity of the Paris thing, and the importance to stop saying all the time to Russia what we are not going to do. I think it was a major mistake. So I really agree with this idea of reestablishing strategic uncertainty. What I find fascinating, if you watch France or if you watch President Macron, you can clearly see this change of position that Camille just described. If you look at the speeches, we had this famous sentences that you should not humiliate Russia in 2022 that really made many other Europeans furious. And that became Russia should not win in 2023. And in this year, in February at the conference, he said Russian defeat is inevitable. So you can really see the evolution of the thinking. And you can also see it on the ground with practical policy decisions. Huh? You can see it with a very clear support of France for Ukrainian NATO membership, out of the reason Camille mentioned, because Ukraine's sovereignty, stability is crucial for Europe's stability and security. You could see it in the really fascinating new commitment of France to NATO. France has been leading the BGTF in February 2022 to Romania. It's now leading the new multinational battle group. France has been reducing its troops in Africa, has raising the troop number for NATO. And in the moment, you have the biggest operational commitments of France is a NATO framework, which for me is really fascinating to see that actually NATO becomes, I would say, structural element for French armed forces. So you can really see a shift here. You can also see it in the nuclear debate that Camille already hinted at. So France is, again, very clearly inviting its European partners to discuss deterrence and to discuss France's role in deterrence and to discuss the future of European defense. So there is a clear move. Also, the initial very dogmatic position on the European defense industrial base, so you only have to buy European, only European ammunition and all that, this has changed. At the Paris conference, Macron also indicated that he would be open to the Czech initiative and be open, more flexible in also buying stuff outside Europe. So you can really see this kind of prise de conscience, so understanding that if the situation is so bad in Ukraine, we have to take the conclusions out of that and we have to think about how to improve our performance as Europeans if, in addition, we simply don't know what America is going to do. And this kind of rather clear change of position and then implementation, I find it fascinating to watch also if I see in Germany how much Germany is changing, but how difficult it is for us to implement our Zeitenwende and how much we struggle in taking the decisions, but then from the decisions kind of really take the implementation. You rightly said Germany is number two in terms of volume, but if you take it by GDP, we are not number two. So I think that's also something that our European allies really don't appreciate when Germany is lecturing the others, saying you should do more, particularly with regard to France, when France is certainly doing less in terms of volume. But France is delivering high-end capabilities like the Scalp missiles, something near to Taurus, what Germany is refusing. So this goes back to what we initially said about this kind of Franco-German malicious comments and finger-pointing and poking, which is really, really not helpful. But I think the way France dealt with the, or how France adapted after the renewed Russian invasion is fascinating to watch, because on the one hand, France said, our overarching goal, European sovereignty, is just reinforced. It's even more urgent than ever. So we stick with the goal, but if you still want to reach that goal, we might need to change a little bit, doing more with NATO, thinking again about nukes, spending differently on defense. But it all seems somehow organized.
But Claude, explain a little bit, that's the second part of my question on the Taurus. Obviously, there's still the reluctance to do that and the reluctance to allow the borrowing on the euro bonds to fund some of this, the reticence to go after frozen assets to help pay for some of this. Explain a little bit from Berlin's perspective, kind of what's driving that.
The Taurus decision has been, the Taurus debate about the missile, whether to deliver it or not, has been around for several months. And it's fascinating to see the German public, also the public media, discussing missile issues in the greatest detail, which is, it's the funny thing, if it would not be so serious. The Chancellor has let the debate go for a very long time. And last Monday, he said he will not deliver it because I have to think about the right wording because it had been discussed a lot in Germany, that German soldiers should at no place and at no circumstances be linked with the goals that Taurus could reach. Sounds a bit complicated, but it is like German soldiers should not got any way clear and near to what Taurus is supposed to do. Behind that is the fear of the German government to become party of the war. And there's a clear fear of escalation. The reason that Scholz gave, so German soldiers should not be anywhere close and Germany can't do what France and the UK is doing, has been criticized by our partners, very strongly by the Brits and by the French. And it has also been criticized by experts because you have actually two ways of delivering Taurus, whether you help the Ukrainians with the targeting and the other things, and you keep full control. But even that, it doesn't require you to be in Ukraine. Or you train the Ukrainians to do it on their own, and you trust them not to misuse it and to target something what we don't want to target. So the reason that German soldiers are needed, I don't see the evidence for that, and many don't see the evidence. But I think behind the whole debate, which has not been very constructive, is the fear of escalation and somehow being a target of Russian retaliation. The problem is, and that brings us back to the red line debates, you know, if you so clearly discuss it in public, this literally invites Russian reactions. And we had the reactions by the speech Putin gave and also by the speech Medvedev gave recently. So I think it's actually plays into the Russian playbook.
Yeah, Camille, you can come in, but and Claude, I still want you to answer on the German reticence to, I mean, we're basically, essentially, they're blocking of EU defense and Ukraine funding efforts, both with the euro bonds and their kind of opposition, seeming opposition to the European peace facility. But Camille, what were you going to say?
Just one quick addition to Claudia's excellent point. I think there is something German specific in this debate. You know, London or Paris are ready to move faster than Washington. Berlin will never move faster than Washington. So there is in that particular case, there is, and you remember that it took the announcement of the delivery of the M1 Abrams, which have not been delivered, but still to unlock Scholz and free the leopards for Ukraine. We are seeing the same thing happening over the Taurus, which is a perception, you know, that in Germany, as long as the US has not delivered a long-range cruise missile fired from a plane, which, by the way, doesn't exist in the US options for Ukraine at the moment for a number of good reasons, Scholz won't move. So, and the bizarre thing is that it goes even beyond this because, the Brits have very smartly said, give us the Taurus and we'll be able to send more scalps. No answer. Experts have said, but you sell the Taurus to South Korea. There are no Bundeswehr soldiers there to enable the South Koreans to operate them. No answer. So I think that Scholz has been essentially asking the 12 reasons for not doing it rather than what are the four problems I need to fix to do it, which I don't think is good policy. And again, I'm fully respectful of the fact that the German system means a Bundestag endorsement for arms sale, which doesn't exist in London or Paris, that there are all sorts of things that are very important, and that's okay. But it seems that it's done the other way around, rather than, okay, what are the problems I need to fix to be able to do something that others are doing, not the US per se, but others are doing, to move to a situation of, okay, let's find, a new reason every week for not doing it, which I find unfortunate, again, not to have the discussion. And that should be, a very open discussion amongst allies on saying, okay, these are the issues I need to fix. How do you fix it yourself when you do that? And how can we move forward?
In German, we say, if you don't want to do something, you find a reason. And if you want to do something, you find a solution. And I think this perfectly describes the situation we have with Taurus, because we find every time again another reason. On the other hand, I have to say that so far the Chancellor calls this behavior besonnen in German, which is a mix of prudent and reasonable and cautious. He gets lots of support in the German public because this image of being at war with Russia, which nobody talks about, which is not the intention, just to make that clear, is a very strong one. So it might surprise, but there is a certain support for the way the Chancellor reasons. And 2 points, and taking up your European questions, Andrea, I think the first is what we can see in the moment in the German domestic debate is that the Chancellor portrays himself, or the SPD, the Social Democrat Party, is portraying himself as the peace Chancellor. We have 4 elections this year in Germany, the European elections and 3 regional elections. And in the 3 regional elections, the right-wing extremist party, the polls give them, tell that they will be the strongest party. And there is a big worry in the German public about escalation, war, all things military, given our very pacifist history of the last years. So this image of a peace chancellor who is cautious and who tries to find solutions to stop the war and is not being militaristic, bellicist and all this, it works. We don't have to agree on that, but I think it's important to underline that he gets support for that. On the other hand, every time Scholz decided to finally deliver weapons, be it the Leopards or anything else, the public was also in support. So in the end, for me, it's about political leadership. And it's about explaining why it matters and why you have to take these decisions. And on this, he is not very strong. But the other point, which is important, and Camille hinted at that, Washington is key to understand or to follow German decision-making. I think one explanation is that the renewed invasion in 2022 has been understood in the German political sphere as an existential threat also to Germany and to the European system as such. So for a very long time, Germany didn't feel militarily threatened. Germany mainly did security policy because we wanted to be a good ally, like in Afghanistan. We wanted to be a good partner for the smaller countries like the Baltics. We wanted to be France's friend in Mali. but not really out of feeling threatened. And with the renewed Russian invasion, that changed. And it was and is felt as an existential military threat to Europe and Germany. And the only one who can really protect us and help us is the US. So to a certain extent, the Russian aggression reinforced the transatlantic relationship that was always strong for Germany. And I insist on transatlantic. It's not NATO. It's really the bilateral relationship Biden and Scholz, which is very strong, very close, much better than Scholz-Macron, much better than Scholz anybody else. And this explains why our Zeitenwende is so utterly transatlantic. So the tank delivery that Camille described, the same for Taurus, the same for the long range, like the HIMARS, the German model or the German thing that would correspond to HIMARS was delivered after the American decision. The Ukraine NATO membership issue, it's always coordinated with the US. So this kind of strong transatlantic focus also explains why there is so little European dimension. Because the transatlantic dimension is the most important one. And this is what I meant when I said earlier, the European dimension of the Zeitenwende is so tiny. Where is the big European vision speech about where we want to take Europe in the next 5 or 10 years? We have the European Skyshield Initiative about air defense, buying stuff together, which has not been coordinated with France, which has not been coordinated with many others, and is mainly a shopping community. Very important, all fine, but it's not a vision for Europe. The German brigade to be permanently stationed in Lithuania has also been announced in a not really happy way, not really coordinated with NATO or partners, and it's not really part of a bigger European picture. So if you look at what Germany is doing on the EU level, it has not really paid much attention to the newly recently published European Defense Industrial Strategy. It is not strong on the European Peace Facility, or rather blocking it. So the old idea we had about Germany as this kind of German interest and European interest, as Chancellor Kohl said, same two sides on the same coin, I don't really see it in the moment. It's this kind of neglect. It's not anti, it's like it doesn't seem to matter, which I find really surprising and I have to say short-sighted. But I wanted just one point. I mean, I have been critical, we have been critical on the delivery of Taurus and many other things, red lines, not red lines. I still think it's important to recognize the way that Germany has made since 2022, compared to where Germany was in January before the renewed Russian invasion, January 2022, where Germany is doing now in defense is for me still impressive and I would even say revolutionary. Sending modern tanks, too late, I know, tanks, air defense, the IRIS-T systems, is remarkable. It was unthinkable before. Germany finally is moving to 2% defense spending this year. I never expected this to happen in my professional lifetime. So Germany, the new defense minister is great. He is trying to reform the ministry, the procurement process, the structure of the Bundeswehr. So I think compared to where Germany is coming from, this is really amazing. The problem is, and this is what we have been debating in the first part of the podcast, the problem is that compared to what it takes for Ukraine to win, compared what it takes to arm Europe, if the US, we don't know what's going to happen with a new president. And compared to what Germany said itself, the chancellor and our finance minister said, we want to be the strongest conventional power in Europe and the leading power. For all those ambitions, it is too little. And this is what makes it so difficult to assess the German position. Germany has been doing so much, but it's still too little to what it claims, what itself wants to do and what it needs to actually keep Europe safe and together.
I have one last question, Jim. Do you want to put one in before? I know we're pretty much at time, but.
Well, no. I it's a bit late. So, but you go ahead.
I think the last thing I want to get at, and you talk about kind of what's needed in the moment. There's been, and we talked about this before we hit record on the podcast, kind of a slew of senior European officials warning about the risks that Russia poses and talking about the potential that Russia could test or attack NATO in the next anywhere between 2 to 7 years. And it was Claude, your German defense minister, who came out, I think, relatively early to say that Russia doesn't pose a challenge to NATO now, but this could be possible in 5 to 7 years. And I wonder how those kinds of statements, because it's not just the German defense minister, it's been the Danes, the Estonians, et cetera, how are those messages resonating with European publics? Is that message being adopted? Are people understanding the level of the threat, or where are we kind of in terms of that public understanding of what senior European leaders are warning about?
Maybe I can give it a shot first. First of all, you will have 50 shades of public understanding across the continent. You know, as Claudia, as you guys, I travel across Europe regularly, and the perceptions in the Baltic states, in the Nordic countries, is different to the perception in Poland, is different to the perception in Germany, is different to the perception in Paris or in Madrid or Rome. So I guess, and that's geography matters, the further you are from the front line, the less there is this perception. First point. Second, I think that's one of the reasons that a number of leaders at multiple levels, military leaders, ministers of defense, and now heads of state and government are, you know, sort of raising this issue of there is a serious risk at some point, is to raise awareness with the public that is a bit trying to evade that conversation and still believes that there is a back to normal paradigm at some point. You know, the war ends and, you know, we get Russian gas again and the energy price goes down and life is beautiful. That's not going to happen. And then the last thing I would add is that, of course, this is not warmongering, and that's the difficult thing to explain to the public and the press. This is a sort of traditional who wants peace prepares for war, and if we mobilize the right resources, if we do send the right messages to Putin, if we deter him from testing NATO, the chances of war are going down, not the other way around. And that's the very tricky part to explain to the public, which says, yeah, but you want to send troops and you're telling us you're warning Putin that he shouldn't go too far and you're spending more and you're entering an arms race and things like that. And there, of course, a number of political parties, for good or bad reasons, some of them because they're really pretty close to the Kremlin, others because it's in their DNA and tradition, tend to buy a bit too easily the Putin's narrative about the risk of war. And it was interesting in France, you know, basically the entire opposition has criticized Macron for being too trigger happy. I don't think he is, and I think it was a mischaracterization of his position. But having said this, it is a mistake, and it's a very important conversation to have, especially with the doubts about where will the US be. And I think this is something that is sinking in with the public and with the elites in Europe at the moment. And say, okay, so we better move now if we want to Trump-proof our security, including in the event of a Putin that would test us. And I wouldn't, you know, I don't think we're in Cold War redux with tens of thousands of Russian tanks in the middle of Europe. But we are in a situation where, you know, Putin might be tempted to test, you know, do you really support the Baltic states? And what if I push them a little around? Are you capable and willing to defend them? And this is where the messages and the raising awareness of the public opinion is super important, because when that moment comes, we need to be ready.
Right. And that's right where I am, particularly on the messaging part, because coming out of Washington, coming out of Trump's mouth over the past couple of months has really given Putin certainly the impression that the U.S. isn't going to be there, and that does embolden him. And so having tough talk come out of Europe is important because it's certainly not coming out of Washington.
I'm not sure whether the tough talk is really coming out of Europe in the moment. I would love to see more of it in the way you phrase it.
Parts of Europe, put it that way.
Parts of Europe. I think there's indeed some debate in European capitals about moments of fragility, of weakness around your presidential elections, where some Europeans are worried whether this is a moment of political uncertainty that might invite someone to test unity and to test cohesion. But I think if we break the debate down to what Camille said, it's about deterrence, clear messaging, and it's about being very clear about Russian motivation, about Russian capabilities, and about timeframes. So the Russian motivation hasn't changed. I mean, Medvedev said some days ago that Russia has strategic borders that are far beyond its geographical borders. There are regular statements about the Russian motivation. And so far, the Russian revisionist goals haven't changed. And revisionists, just for the record, inside where they unbuild democratic and what is left of the democratic order, and to the outside and changing borders. So the Russian motivation hasn't changed and it is still there. The Russian capabilities are improving. I mean, Russia is producing on a bigger level. And once the war stops, it will be able to focus all its energy on reproducing military kids and also mobilizing soldiers. So motivation is still there. Capabilities will improve after the war. And the time frame then is key. How long does it take Russia, once the war stops, or the fighting, not the war, the fighting stops, to rebuild all this and to be able to really test someone? And this is a time frame for us Europeans to be ready, and to be ready earlier, as Camille rightly said, to be able to signal to Russia, the old deterrent signal, it's not worth it. The costs you will have are much bigger than the win you hope to get. But I think this understanding is for the various European publics, and particularly the German public, very difficult to really swallow. It's to say, as long as Russia hasn't changed its ambitions, as long as it still thinks waging war is a tool to get what I want, as long as this is the case, there will be no peace and stability in Europe, and we have to prepare. But that is also the learning process to recognize we are here in a very, very long-term scenario. Because you don't demilitarize quickly. And you have Russia, a deeply militarized, not only government, but society. If you look at the way Putin has changing this society in every dimension since he went back to power. So I think this recognizing the long-term change, military power is back. We have to prepare for a long-term conflict with Russia in the military, but also below the military, you know? I mean, all those destabilization efforts over the last weeks, particularly targeted at Germany, with the release of the Taurus leaks, this leaked conversation of high-level German officers. I mean, this is all part of a bigger Russian playbook we have to be aware of, and we have to prepare not only for now, but in the long-term perspective. And this learning curve, I mean, it's not a nice one to have. So it's not easy to communicate and to take the lessons from that, which all have a certain price tag on it.
And it's the same.
Just to add one sentence to what Claudia said. I think from a US perspective, you need to pay a lot of attention to the sort of hybrid war that is currently waged on European publics and European political scene, because our political cycle is slightly ahead of yours, and it's going to be ugly. You know, as we enter the European election, you can see that the battle of narratives, and there are enough useful idiots in Germany, France, and elsewhere to sort of try to see that. We've already seen the damage that Fico and Orban are doing to the European effort to do more for Ukraine. We do see how the Russian propaganda story fuels, you know, the legitimate concerns of Polish farmers, of French and German farmers, uses the far right and far left parties to their advantage. And that's really something that I think is of concern, including when thinking of an election year in the US.
It's a tough picture. It is. But this was really an excellent discussion. I think we're going to have to do it again because there's a lot we didn't get to. Camille, I also wanted to ask you about the French security guarantees for Moldova. But I mean, so we'll this is a conversation that I think is to be continued.
And the nuclear debate as well. We didn't. I was going to ask you about that, but there's no time. So
yeah. Oh, we could do a funny Franco-German debate on the French nuclear dialogue. How you call it, Camille? How shall we call it?
It's not a dialogue yet, for sure, but it's a conversation.
Let's debate. Call it a conversation. Let's put it conversation.
All right. Well, then we'll put a pin in that and we'll pick this up in a future podcast. So thank you for doing this. This was really excellent. And I'm so glad you both could join.
Yeah. Thank you
Thanks
so much.
Thanks for having us. It was great.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.